read tonight from Genesis chapter 7. Genesis chapter 7. We took a break from our series on creation and evolution last week. We want to get back to it tonight. Our most recent message on this subject had to do with population, because I think when you look at the world's population, it supports the idea of a young earth that is 6,000 to 7,000 years old rather than 4.6 billion years old. It's interesting that they throw that figure out there for the creation of the universe, and it's pretty consistent. You know, everywhere you read about evolution, you know, the earth, sometimes maybe they round it down and say 4 billion years, but in looking today, it seems that many suggest it's 4.6 billion years old. Has anybody ever stopped and asked the question how they come up with that figure anyway? Of course, dinosaurs lived 65 million years ago. That's what you always read in the textbooks. And mankind did not evolve until approximately 1 million years ago, according to evolutionary scientists. But when you think about that and look at average population growth and understand the only data that we have in regards to population is from the time of Christ up until now. So we only have records the last 2,000 years, and in that particular message we looked at the average population growth, and if it had been anywhere near consistent throughout, you know, mankind's existence, the population on the face of the earth would be an astronomical number. I mean, astronomical. But when you approach it from a biblical perspective and say, okay, let's imagine the world started with two people 4,400 years ago, or we should say eight people, Noah, his wife, his sons, and their wives. If, you know, the populations began with eight 4,400 years ago, what would we expect the population to be today? Well, we would expect it to be exactly what it is, 6 billion plus people. When you look at how many people there were, Jacob and his sons of the nation of Israel that went down into Egypt, when you take average population growth from those 70 during their stay in Egypt until now, and you come up with, you know, using the formula, you know, for generations and such, it would seem that there would be 13 million Jews today. And lo and behold, that's about how many Jews are on the earth today. And that's with them going through the Holocaust, where what, 6-7 million Jews were killed. And so again, there's enough play in the numbers to attribute less population growth in generations prior to the time of Christ. And so again, I don't want to rehearse that entire message, but population and population growth appears to support a young earth position. And on top of looking at that, we also looked at whether or not the world is overpopulated, because this is a mantra of the left and of liberals and such, and it doesn't appear that the world is overpopulated at all. One particular researcher suggested that the Earth could comfortably sustain 50 million people. And so I take that for what it's worth. Again, we gave some statistics. The world's population could fit in the city of Jacksonville, Florida. You could give every four-member family a 5,000-square-foot house and put them all in the state of Texas. You could give every single individual a 1,200-square-foot house and still fit them all within the boundaries of the state of Texas. And so, while some want to suggest that the earth is overpopulated, I don't believe that's the case. And of course, those who suggest the earth is overpopulated are the same ones that want to promote abortion to bring population under control, and they're the same group that want to support euthanasia, that is, the killing of the elderly who are no longer quote-unquote useful to society. And that's absolutely tragic that we've come to such a place in our society. But not surprising, when you embrace evolution, that's one of the normal reactions to it. Because if there's no moral absolutes, if there's no creator, then we as a society can determine what we want to do, and You know, taking life, whether it be at the beginning or at the end of someone's life, is completely acceptable if there is no God, but we know there is a God. Tonight, what I want to look at is the fossil record. The fossil record. And again, I've been doing a lot of reading, a lot of research in regards to the fossil record. And, you know, I have to admit, when I try to approach one of these subjects, really, you know, I come away just recognizing how little I really know of all of these things. And in many ways, I rely on Bible-believing people who are experts in these particular fields. I'm not an expert. And I say that just, you know, so that, you know, if it's determined at some point in the future that I'm wrong, you know, about one particular thing, you know, well, I completely understand, because again, I'm not an expert at this. I would certainly love to take and to study geology, to study the fossil record. And again, you know, if I was a full-time preacher, I could perhaps take the time, you know, to read and to study, you know, for a week on this particular subject and come to grasps with certain things. But I'm not an expert. You know, I have studied the subjects of creation and evolution at different times throughout my ministry. I think it's one of the most important things for Bible-believing people to study, because it is at the very foundation of what we believe. And I think we'll even see further tonight that creationism is the belief of Bible-believing people, and evolution is just as much a religion as quote-unquote biblical Christianity. And I say quote-unquote to religion. Evolution is just as much a religion, but it's the religion for atheists, or the religion of atheists. And so, again, let's look. I've got a couple of kind of primary points I want to drive home this evening, something that fascinated me as I learned about it, especially learning it from the mouths of evolution scientists themselves. Well, let's read some here in Genesis chapter 7, verse 17. It says, "And the flood was 40 days upon the earth, and the waters increased, and bare up the ark, and it was lift up above the earth. And the waters prevailed, and were increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark went up upon the face of the waters." And notice this, "And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered." There's no mistaking the terminology that is used here. The highest mountains were covered by the waters from the flood. This wasn't a local geographical flood. This, according to the Bible, was a worldwide flood. Verse 20 says, 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail. That would be 22 and a half feet. A cubit is approximately a foot and a half. So approximately 22 and a half foot above the tallest mountain. It says in verse 21, "And all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl," that's the birds, "and of cattle, and of beast, and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of life, of all that was in the dry land died." Do you notice it does not say that all of the fishes died? They didn't die. I was recently reading some information online, and I can't remember if it was an article and then there was posts at the end of the article, but I think it was in regards to a scientific discussion. And someone, you know, was kind of mocking, you know, the Bible and the flood in particular, saying, "Well, it says everything died. Well, what about all the fish? They live in water." Well, it doesn't say, stupid, that all the fishes died. That's what I want to say. People are ignorant. They attack things and they mock them before they even know the whole story. And, you know, but again, what, I guess, should we expect from someone who rejects the moral truths of the Bible? So again, every living thing, not the fishes, but every living thing on dry land died. The highest mountains were covered with the waters of the flood. And I point that out because when you look at the fossil record, you find fossils and even ocean-dwelling crustaceans. You find them on the tops of the highest mountains. They're fossils. And you're thinking to yourself, well, how is that possible? Because these creatures only dwell in the sea. So how did these fossils come to be at the tops of the highest mountains? Well, again, that's why I chose this as our text, because I think the Bible explains to us precisely how this came to pass. You know, the Bible references many of the sciences. The book of Ecclesiastes, as well as the book of Psalms, talks about the hydrological cycle. You know, how water evaporates up into the air, and the moisture then, under certain conditions, begins to fall to the earth, and then it goes to the creeks, which goes to the streams, which goes to the rivers, which eventually goes back to the ocean, which is evaporated up into the sky again, and this process repeats itself over and over again. The Bible talks about the hydrological cycle. The Bible references, or appears to at least reference, the type of environment that existed before the flood. And we look at certain references in the first few chapters of Genesis, and it appears to indicate that there was a water canopy. And so we come up with our theories in regards to a water canopy in the environment of the earth. The Bible references population, and therefore, you know, we gave a particular message on the subject of population because we have a very precise starting point for the creation of man and for the replenishing of the earth after Noah's flood. And so we can look at Bible references and teach on these things. The Bible references stars. It references procreation and kinds, you know, rather than species. It references kinds. And so we can look at the information that the Bible gives us in regards to these subjects and have evidence or support or talk about these things, you know, and what the Bible has to say about them. Now, the Bible never references fossils. Never references, to my knowledge, somebody digging into the ground and finding a fossil of some ancient creature of the past or even a more recent creature on the earth. But there are references to animals in the Bible that appear to be extinct. But you know, oftentimes, I think I pointed one of them out a couple of weeks ago, oftentimes scientists decree that a certain animal has become extinct only to find it later on. And sometimes those animals are said to have been extinct for millions of years. And then, lo and behold, there's one of them. What are they going to do one day if they find a dinosaur? I was even reading Henry Morris's book today, and he had that old picture of that, you know, ocean-dwelling dinosaur that the Japanese fishing boat found in 1974. Now, it's dismissed by evolutionary scientists, but boy, it sure looks like a long-necked dinosaur with flippers to me. What happens if they find one of these creatures alive? What happens if the Loch Ness Monster is one of those creatures that supposedly lived 65 million years ago and yet they're not completely extinct? Well, I don't think that they'll be changing their mind regardless. And there are references to the flood that would help to explain what we do see in the fossil record. You know, one of the things I greatly desire to do tonight, and which is one of the reasons why I postponed this message last week, was to put up for you on a white screen the model, the fossil record model that is found in nearly every biology book, every textbook that's used in public schools, secular colleges and such. I'm sure you've all seen it, where it has the different ages, and most of those I can't even pronounce, but they have all the different ages. You know, here's your oldest soil, and here's what they call it, this period and this period. And then next to it, they have the types of fossils that are found in those layers of dirt. And when you look at it, you can see it starts with very simple organisms. Small creatures that aren't, at least appear not to be, very complicated. Sometimes they're a lot more complicated than we think. And so you go from, let me just kind of say this in general, you go from, you know, little insects, maybe you even got plants in there somewhere, you know, but you go from little insects to little creatures to fish to they come up out of the water to animals to birds and to man. And again, I guess, you know, logically you can see, oh, that seems to make sense. Simple creatures to more complex. Single cell organisms all the way up to mankind, who's at the top of the food chain. And it appears all systematic. It appears very structured until you begin to discover that in the fossil record, everything is not as systematic as they like for us to believe. You don't only find these simple organisms in this certain layer of soil. Many times there's other more complex creatures that are found there, and maybe found there with the more simple organisms. I remember years ago watching a movie from Kent Hovind, and he had, you know, these layers of soil that the scientist, you know, said, well, this layer, you know, it's 10 million years old, and this layer, it's 1 million years old, and this layer, it's only 500,000 years old, and then all of a sudden you see over here in those soils a tree that extends the length of all of them. And I'm like, well, that's amazing. That tree goes from the soil that's 500,000 years old all the way to the one that's 10 million? How in the world did that happen? And it's a fossilized tree, you understand. Again, it's not all as simple as they like for us to believe. It's just as likely when you look at that thing that the first creatures that were to be buried in Noah's flood were the little insects. Couldn't get away. And then you'd have animals, smaller animals, larger animals, birds, and people. Just understand that both creationists and evolutionists look at the very same data. The very same data that's found in the fossil record, they simply interpret it differently based on their worldview. Evolutionists see the fossil record as documenting the evolutionary changes in living creatures throughout the ages. They see it going from simple to more complex organisms. Creationists see the fossil record as a testimony to God's judgment upon the earth during the flood of Noah's day. Therefore, the key question or questions are, does the fossil record support the evolutionary theory of simple organisms developing into more complex, or does the fossil record support the destruction of life in one age? Those are the key questions. And you know, with those key questions in mind, you know what I would like to do if I was a scientist? I would go about trying to determine which the fossil record supports. Which does it support? Here's some things to consider in regards to the fossil record. There is not a single true transitional evolutionary sequence that has yet been excavated anywhere in the world. And don't take my word for it, that's what Henry Morris says. While this has been pointed out, and again, don't take Henry Morris's word for it, in a moment we'll see that the evolutionary scientists say the very same thing. While this has been pointed out by creationists for years, most simply assume that evolutionary scientists' assertions are true. They just assume they're true. And they don't question them. They don't apply the rules of critical thinking to the things that they say. Even Stephen Jay Gould, and if you've studied this subject at all, you've read and heard things that he has said and written. He's a staunch evolutionist. Teaches at Harvard, I believe. He said all paleontologists, notice he says all, know that the fossil record contains precious little in any way intermediate forms. And he goes on, transitions between major groups are characteristically abrupt. In other words, you don't see any transitional creatures developing basically, how about from a monkey to a man? There's no in-between creature. Folks, there's no in-between between the vertebrates and the invertebrates. There's no in-between from the fishes to the amphibians. And the one is supposed to have developed in the other. There's no transitional creatures from the amphibian to the reptile, from the mammal to the bird. And we talked about how some of the supposed missing links from monkey to man are given. They've been a hoax. They found out to be untrue. So really, there's no missing links even from a monkey to a man. And again, Stephen Jay Gould, he admitted, all paleontologists know that the fossil record contains precious little in the way of intermediate forms. Precious little. Some of these type of scientists speculate that the transitions occur so rapidly that they leave no fossil record behind. That's what they're beginning to say. And have said maybe, I don't know, for how many years now. One man said, a species will undergo little measurable change. I want you to think about this for a moment. A species will undergo little measurable change in form during 10 to the 5th power to 10 to the 7th power of generations. That's a big number, okay? So for millions of generations, the fossil record now reveals that species typically survive for 100,000 generations. He says even a million or more without evolving very much at all. And so we seem forced to conclude that most evolution takes place rapidly. Now this is a change from Darwinism. And why are they changing? Because they have to admit, when you look at the fossil record, there's no transitional creatures. There's none there. Okay, so now they're saying maybe this wasn't a change from species to another gradually, little by little, in incremental steps. Maybe what happened is it just stayed the same, and then all of a sudden there was a rapid change in that creature. He transitioned to another creature, and it was so quick that we don't have any record of it at all in the fossil record. Henry Morris said, the logic employed by evolutionists is amazing. Since species undergo little measurable change for at least 100,000 generations, therefore, most evolution takes place rapidly. Folks, this is nothing more than faith. Faith in the evolutionary process. Believing it's true regardless of what the data suggests. Can't they for a moment entertain the idea that maybe the biblical creation account is true? Of course, we've already seen why they can't do that. Anything but God. This theory of the evolutionist is called punctuated equilibrium. I've made an effort to memorize that so I can use it when debating evolutionists. Matter of fact, you should do the same thing, because you'll sound like you're the smartest person on the face of the earth using big words like that. Punctuated equilibrium. Go up to your friends. Have you ever heard of punctuated equilibrium? Now, equilibrium, you know, means static. You know, when I think, don't they even talk about equilibrium when it comes to your balance? Now, equilibrium is when things are static, when they're unchanged, when there's little fluctuation. Punctuated, what do you do to a sentence at the end? You punctuate it. So what they're saying is equilibrium. For thousands and maybe millions of generations, things remain static. And in that time frame, at the end, is punctuated with a rapid evolutionary process, some type of mutation taking place. Again, Stephen Jay Gould said, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record, notice he admits it, persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. In any local area, a species does not arise gradually. By the gradual transformation of its ancestors, it appears all at once and fully formed. I mean, it's like magic. I mean, one day, there's a monkey, and he just gives birth to a man. It's a miracle. Henry Morris said, evolutionists may interpret such data in terms of punctuated equilibrium if they wish, but this is arguing not from evidence, but from a lack of evidence. Carlton Brett, not a creationist, avid evolutionist, said, did life on Earth change steadily or gradually through time? The fossil record emphatically says no. And so again, is he going to become a creationist because of that? No. He says status, and again, just things staying the same, he's talking about punctuated equilibrium, has become interesting as a central prediction of our theory. I got big question marks next to that. What? Things staying the same for long periods of time. This has become one of our foundational principles as an evolutionist. Say what? No, that's one of the foundational principles of a creationist. That things stay the same. That kind produces kind. And again, what these guys are talking about is what we find in the Bible, kind after kind. Think about the logic that they're applying here. Think about the logic that they're applying. It's the same logic that we apply to biblical truth. Okay? It's the same logic. I think even at the nursing home, I made the statement this afternoon that when we see an apparent contradiction in the Bible, or there's a question that we have in regards to the Bible and what we see in the world that we cannot reconcile, what do? Throw our Bibles away? So much for that. That book contradicts, so much for that. What it says in here is not consistent with what I see in the world. Throw it away. No. What do? We understand that the supposed contradiction is due to our limitations. It's due to us not having a complete understanding as of yet. But we don't throw our Bibles away. Why? Because we're absolutely convinced that this is true. I don't fault the evolutionist for his logic. I fault him in how he applies that logic. Because what's his faith in? His faith's not in the Bible. His faith is in the evolutionary theory. And I hope you all understand me here because this is so significant. This is why so many authors have said for so long that evolution is nothing more than a religion. But it's the religion of atheists. They take the world and what they see and they filter everything through the evolutionary process, and it has fit. And if it doesn't appear to fit, it must be due to a lack of understanding on their part. But evolution has to be true. You see, they do the same thing with the theory of evolution that we do with the truths of the Bible. The evidence is stacked against us. The fossil record, boy, doesn't seem to support us. It seems to support the creation account.
But we know that's a lie.
That's what they say, and we know evolution is true. So we'll just come up with great big words. Boy, I listened to one guy, and he used the biggest words. I'd have had to look half of them up. Use a big word, punctuated equilibrium. And boy, people just stand back and say, oh, he is smart. No, all he's saying is things just go along fine, and hocus pocus, wave my wand, and boom, went from a monkey to a man. It's not smart. It's just a big word to hide their ignorance. This fascinated me when I was reading about it. Fascinated me. I got online again to look at some information about punctuated equilibrium. Watched the videos, and you know, as I sat there and I listened to him talk about things as though they were fact, knowing that much of what they were saying was completely erroneous. But the world lets them get away with it. Why? Because the devil holds people captive at his will, and they just follow him. I tell you, I still contend that the biggest lie that's ever been, that society's ever been bought into accepting, is the lie of evolution. I had another observation here. The very existence of fossils supports the idea of catastrophe. Let me say that again. The very existence of fossils supports the idea of a catastrophe. And I could go into great lengths and explain this, but simply put, let me just say, when animals die, they quickly decompose on the surface unless they are somehow rapidly covered by dirt, by sediment. And then that dirt and sediment is compacted and hardened, creating the fossil. Nearly every week when I drive back and forth to work there on the highway on 63, I see an animal. Sometimes it stays there a while. And the vultures come and they eat it. I watched a whole deer disappear that way a couple weeks ago. And the rain and the snow and the wind fall. And you know what happens to that animal's remains? They decompose. And they're gone. So you see, that's what happens naturally. Well, then how in the world do we have fossils? How do we have fossils? How did they come into play? Well, we believe it's because of a catastrophe. We believe it's a result of the flood. There's the Green River Formation in Wyoming. And this is a formation of fossils. It covers 16,000 square kilometers. I don't know, that's probably about 9,000 miles. Wow, yeah, 9,000 miles. I'm just guessing, because what, a kilometer, wait, it's actually twice that, isn't it? So it's probably more like 30,000 miles. No, I was right. Because a kilometer is a little bit more than a half a mile, right? So you cut this in half, and that's how many miles you'd have. So it's a big, big formation of fossils. And I don't know if this is the only type of fossil creature in this area, but there's a lot of catfish, which is interesting in and of itself, because, you know, catfish swim. They like to swim at the bottom of places. But there's all sizes of catfish. Matter of fact, some of them still have their skin and other soft parts intact. And they're fossilized? How could that happen? You see, it couldn't happen if the creature died and natural elements took their course. You wouldn't have any flesh remaining. Because what the vultures didn't eat, I use that term loosely, because he would be in the river. But what the vultures didn't eat, the rain, the wind, and the water would deteriorate. And yet, you know, it says that this formation by evolutionary scientist models is supposed to be 60 billion years old. 60 billion years old, and we still have catfish flesh? How did that happen? While exactly how this did occur, probably a subject for debate, it appears obvious to me that it was a catastrophe that caused this. That took all these fish, took all this water where they were, squished them together, compacted them into the mud, creating these fossils with flesh intact, you understand? I mean hard, but you have the impression of the flesh. All together in this 9,000 mile area. There's the petrified forests of Yellowstone Park. There's said to be 50 successive fossil forests that have been counted there. And of course, evolutionists say it would have taken 1,000 years for each of these forests to create, and so that discounts the biblical age of the earth. But these trees do not appear to have been grown where they're found. No, instead they appear to be transported, roots and all, to where they are. Matter of fact, on those trees, you don't find any limbs and you don't find any bark. And you know when that occurs? If you take logs and trees and you throw them in the river and you send them down and you transport them that way, they rub up against each other and all the limbs, whatever might be left, are broken off, and all the bark is also rubbed off. These logs are in horizontal positions, and they appear to be angled to suggest a log jam. So again, what possibly could have happened? And again, when Mount St. Helens erupted, it created the same type of circumstances there in Washington, in the state of Washington. And so I think we can understand during the time of Noah's flood and the, you know, I forget exactly the wording that's used, but you know, the waters didn't just come from above, but there was great activity that came from below the earth's surface, and it was probably some of it volcanic activity, and the volcanoes were erupting, causing a lot of these trees just to be moved instantaneously or ushered down a body of water until they got stuck, until the mud covered them completely and they became fossilized. Again, there's so much, I guess, I could say about the fossil record. There's so many little interesting pieces of information. I was reading about one of them today, and I think Kent Holden brought it up in the past, but there was I hesitate to bring it up because I don't have all the details, but I don't know if it was a fly in amber or something, but this amber was supposedly something that was created 40 million years ago. And you don't see it today, but somehow there's a fly in there. And when you look at the fly, he's the same exact type of fly that we have today. How'd that fly get in there? I don't know. How in the world is it possible for that thing to be 40 million years old and has survived up to this day? Again, let me just say, kind of in summary, when you look at the fossil record, it supports the biblical account of creation and the biblical account of the flood. And I'd encourage each of us to do some research on our own about this. And if nothing else, memorize the word punctuated equilibrium. I keep saying it because I want to memorize it. Punctuated equilibrium. Because I want to ask my atheist friends, do they know what that is? And do they know why evolutionary scientists came up with that theory? It's because the fossil record does not support their presuppositions. But like I said, don't ever think that just because the evidence doesn't support their theory that they're going to move from it and embrace creationism. That's not going to happen. Matter of fact, just to show you how paleontologists understand this truth. I watched a movie once, and it was one of those, you know, apocalypse type movies. And this thing came up out of the earth, which was clearly alien in form. Matter of fact, it rose some people from the dead when they got in close proximity to it. I think they got to where they were referencing it as God. It was just some kind of energy. But what they discovered in studying this thing, because one particular man had a fatal disease, but lo and behold, he was in close proximity to this, and he was healed. And so what they realized is this thing, whatever it was, altered DNA, made it more pure. And so what they speculated in the movie was that maybe this is what happened in the evolutionary process of man. Maybe this is how we went from one species to the next, is that this thing came in and interjected itself and we became more complex. And they thought it was there now to maybe help us to catapult to that next step of our evolutionary process. But even in the movie, they admitted that there was no transitional creatures. And maybe this thing explained how we got from a monkey to a man. So again, they wouldn't have the theory if the evidence supported evolution. But punctuated equilibrium is a theory because the fossil record does not support their theory. It instead supports the biblical account of creation. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for thy word. And Lord, we believe it. We believe it whether there's evidence or not. But Lord, but because we believe the word of God, we certainly believe that the evidence in the world will support what it has to say. And Lord, I pray that you'd help our understanding of the Bible and our understanding of some of these things to be of a help to other people who are in search of the truth. And Lord, even this week, might you bring us across the path of someone who's searching, who needs the truth of the gospel, and might you have prepared us in such a way that we could effectively minister to them and lead them to Jesus Christ for salvation. Lord, bless and use the things that were said tonight, and I'll thank you for it, for I pray in your name. Amen. Stand with me.